The Trump-bashing attorney Michael Avenatti comes to Iowa to rev up Democrats and to test the waters for 2020. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Avenatti also had a message for Democrats. You're fooling yourselves if you don't think 2020 will be more about personalities than ideas. We'll talk about that with our analysts, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Also, the defense rests in Paul Manafort's fraud trial after calling no witnesses. Of course, we need to ask Jim and Wayne about that escalating Omarosa-Trump feud and takeaways from yesterday's primaries. Politics Day, right ahead. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Once again, Politics Wednesday has arrived. So glad to have with us our analysts, Wayne Moyer, the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick is with us as well in our Ames studio, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Good to have you on board, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
We want to invite our listeners, too. We'll be talking about a variety of topics this hour. Keep this note, political junkies, on your refrigerator or wherever it's handy. You never know when you might want to jump in with an experience, a comment, or a question about our political landscape. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about the surprising announcement by the Trump-bashing attorney Michael Avenatti, came to Iowa on the weekend to test the waters for 2020. Yes, he says he's exploring the possibility of a presidential run. We'll hear from him a little bit later in the hour and get Wayne and Jim's thoughts. Also, the defense rests in the Paul Manafort fraud trial, calling no witnesses, the defense. Also, that escalating feud between Omarosa and Donald Trump. We'll talk about the implications there as well. Let's jump in first, gentlemen, with yesterday's primaries. Let's comment on primaries in four states: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Connecticut, and Vermont. Jim, what were the takeaways for you?
Well, I think one of the immediate takeaway was the size of the Democratic turnout. If you look at it both in Wisconsin and Minnesota, which I particularly honed in on, that I think was an important kind of takeaway. And again, it suggests the kind of activism that the Democrats are about. The second takeaway for me was the results in terms of sort of a left-right kind of races that we're going to have, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, in terms of the governor's race in Wisconsin is going to have that left-right component with Trump backers on the Republican side and the critics from the Democratic side. The same holds true. Tim Pawlenty was defeated in Minnesota, kind of surprisingly, and by a fairly wide margin. And a vocal Trump supporter won the Republican nomination and will go against Tim Walz on the Democratic side. So kind of the left-right kind of split was the thing that struck me. And the third point that I saw was the diversity of candidates, particularly on the Democratic side. There was a transgender candidate won the Democratic nomination in Vermont. An African-American won for the first time, a woman in Connecticut, and a Muslim woman won a congressional seat, a nomination for a congressional seat in Minnesota. So lots of takeaways here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, do you have anything to add on your observations about yesterday's primaries?
Well, the one thing that yesterday's primaries sort of confirmed that had begun earlier, and this I guess follows on what Jim was already saying, is that Republican candidates who have Trump's endorsement tend to win the primaries. So he's clearly helping in terms of at least Republican candidates having views similar to his. Whether that will work in the general elections is questionable. And in fact, that congressional race in Ohio, that special election a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. indicated it might not work in the general election.
Right. A fair generalization from what I'm hearing and when we've been looking at the last few months of primaries, the Democrats, this is very broad brush generalization, the Democrats going for diversity, and the Republicans voters going for the supporters of Trump, Jim, right? I mean, that's what we're outlining here.
That's really right. But it also raises a kind of another issue, particularly for the Democrats, and that is, do they have the kind of unity? I mean, some of these candidates have been supported by sort of Democratic Socialist candidate from New York and Bernie Sanders, and others are more moderate. Now, are these candidates simply candidates that will fit their particular district and will not have any kind of reverberation in terms of, say, the governor's races or the Senate races in some of those states here? So, yes, there is this kind of diversity on the Democratic side. There are these more Trump adherents on the Republican side. But, again, I think really the test will be in terms of the kind of the general election, whether either of these kind of patterns will hold forth.
Mm-hmm.
If I could add just a little to that, I think the issue for the Democrats will be the 2020 presidential elections. The congressional races will largely be settled on local issues, but can the Democratic Party come together by 2020?
Right, and we'll ask those big questions a little bit later in the hour, Wayne, when we talk about that visit to Iowa a few days ago by Michael Avenatti, and his warning, I don't know if a warning or message for the Democratic Party. We'll get your interpretation of that, gentlemen. But let's move forward. Well, with this, what's been dominating the headlines, I guess there's been talk about whether this has been overplayed in the media, how much it means, what it matters. Hope Hicks, Sean Spicer, Steve Bannon. Well, we can add another to that list. Actually, she went quite a while ago, another former White House staffer in the headlines. She is not going quietly. The former White House aide, Amarosa Manigault-Newman, someone who had been one of the Republican president's most prominent black supporters. She's now selling a tell-all book called Unhinged. It accuses the president of racism, of using the N-word. She promises to expose her former boss and the people she now calls liars who she used to work alongside. She writes in her book many things. Here's a quote: "His mental decline could not be denied." Let's listen to a little bit of her. This is on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. She talked about her firing from the White House. And the audio, this is what's interesting. Audio secretly recorded of the conversation inside the Situation Room. This is with Chief of Staff John Kelly, I believe the first voice you'll hear. Let's listen to that audio and her comments about it.
I think it's important to understand that if we make this a friendly departure, we can all be, you know, you can look at your time here in the White House as a year of service to the nation, and then you can go on without any type of difficulty in the future relative to your reputation.
How did you take that comment about your reputation?
It's very obvious a threat. He goes on to say that things can get ugly for you. The Chief of Staff of the United States, under the direction of the President of the United States, threatening me on damage to my reputation and things getting ugly for me. That's downright criminal.
Okay, we'll hear a secret recorded conversation with the president in just a moment. What do you make of that, Jim, a dismissal by John Kelly in those terms?
Well, I assume there must have been some action that he was referencing that she had taken before that would lead to this. I'm not sure that it was just, well, it's hard to determine, frankly, whether this was, you know, as she suggested, you know, just confronting with her reputation. It sounds like to me, and this is by inference only, that there must have been some action previously that had raised a concern. Given what we know about, you know, Kelly, who's, I think, has a reputation of a pretty straight shooter here, and that's why he was brought in the White House to try to create some order. But, it's very puzzling.
Right, a lot of blanks to fill in there. That could be something you could put it in another context where it would have a different spin than she gave it, as, in her words, downright criminal. Let's listen to her recorded phone call with the president that she says took place after she was let go from the White House. Here's that audio.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw on the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
God damn it. I don't love you leaving at all.
I don't love you leaving at all. Interesting formulation there. Wayne, what's your interpretation of that?
Well, the fact that a major decision is made that the president doesn't know about is itself troubling. But I think the main thing that I'm getting out of all of this, this again, it looks like a situation of drip, 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 sort of like the Hillary Clinton emails in the campaign. And she apparently has a lot of tapes, and they're likely to come out one by one by one over the next weeks or so. And each one of these, it seems to me, it is embarrassing to the, so far at least, embarrassing to the president, and could well undercut some of his support.
Mm-hmm. Here's President Trump's tweet. Wacky Omarosa. Omarosa already has a fully signed non-disclosure agreement. This was from the president on Monday via Twitter to acknowledge something that I guess his aides have declined to confirm for months, that this White House, Donald Trump's White House, has aides sign non-disclosure agreements. Now, non-disclosure agreements, NDAs, are a routine matter for anyone in corporate America. But, Jim, what about for someone serving in government?
Yeah, I had never heard of that until this revelation came out. Certainly, you know, there's non-disclosure agreements if somebody has a security clearance, but somebody just serving in government, I mean, the whole idea of having whistleblower protection, which now has been written into law, really operates against this kind of non-disclosure agreement. So this is
right.
very unusual, and probably, as most experts have said, they're simply unenforceable.
Right, and here we have to distinguish, don't we, between when you are given a security clearance, you're barred from revealing classified information, top secret information. But that's
the point of a security clearance.
That's the point of a security clearance, but it doesn't give you a blanket, does it, to not talk about anything connected with your service?
I wouldn't think so. No, mm-hmm. I think that you'd still have, you know, the right to. And certainly, if past is prologue here, we've seen all these books written by people that formerly were in administrations, not just this administration, mm-hmm. but virtually all administrations, talking about their experiences and giving various insights. And this suggests that not only that there has not been non-disclosure agreements, but that there's no restrictions on this.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, do you see it that way?
I do. One question I have is whether this is actually a non-disclosure agreement for her work in the White House or a non-disclosure agreement that she made with the Trump campaign when she was working with them before.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah.
A big court case is here before we know for sure how much that she will be constrained.
Okay, so maybe we're just talking about this bubble from January of, 2017 until December of 2017 when she was dismissed, in which she was in the service of our country. Before that, in the campaign, which is essentially private, right?
Yeah, apparently the Trump administration now has called for arbitration over her campaign activities and any revelations that she makes. I'm not sure what exactly that means and who would be the arbiter, if you will, of this, but that's the effort that I think that Wayne is referring to. That during the campaign, there may have been, you know, some kind of, again, campaigns would be non-governmental, and so those disclosure agreements might be valid.
Mm-hmm. She has also accused the president of using the N-word. Says there are recordings of it, which she has heard. Trump on Monday denied the existence of any tape from The Apprentice, in which it's claimed he used that racial epithet. Tuesday, he called her a dog. And as you mentioned, a campaign taking legal action against her. Let's hear from the White House press secretary when asked at a briefing if the president used the N-word to describe African Americans. Sarah Huckabee Sanders says she can't guarantee he had not used it.
I can't guarantee anything, but I can tell you that the president addressed this question directly. I can tell you that I've never heard it. I can also tell you that if myself or the people that are in this building serving this country every single day, doing our very best to help people all across this country and make it better, if at any point we felt that the president was who some of his critics claim him to be, we certainly wouldn't be here. This is a president who is fighting for all Americans, who is putting policies in place that help all Americans, particularly African Americans. Just look at the economy alone. This president, since he took office in the year and a half that he's been here, has created 700,000 new jobs for African Americans.
Okay. What do you think of that question and that answer? Should she be able to make that guarantee, Jim, that he hadn't used ever the N-word?
Well, I suppose she could ask him if he, you know, if he would, if he would say so. I don't know if it should go back before the presidential election or whether while he's been in the White House. I think it's probably certainly entirely appropriate while he's been president to discern that.
Mm-hmm. She says she's been interviewed by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Let's dovetail into that. She said she would not say whether she's appeared before a grand jury in Mueller's investigation. That, of course, regarding the 2016 election. Here's a quote from her. There's a lot of corruption that went on both in the campaign and the White House. I'm going to blow the whistle on all of it. I'm very interested in exposing what was happening behind the scenes, telling MSNBC. So maybe Wayne, the drip, 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 more tapes. Certainly, Mueller is going to be interested. Already has possession of those tapes. Let's talk about another facet of the Mueller investigation, an offshoot. Yesterday, Paul Manafort's defense rested its case, calling no witnesses in the former Trump campaign chairman's tax evasion and bank fraud trial. Manafort not choosing to testify. I guess perhaps this morning as we speak, perhaps closing arguments. This is the first trial to emerge from the special counsel investigation. Manafort accused of hiding millions of dollars he received in advising Ukrainian politicians. Of course, his financial mistakes are being blamed by his defense on his former deputy Rick Gates. Wayne, thoughts on the outcome of this trial? We're hearing news at the top of the hour that, the prosecutors say they have overwhelming evidence, and that's the spin a prosecutor likes to put on any sort of trial like this. But what do you make of what you're hearing, what we know?
Well, I sort of read a summary this morning of the presentation, and to me it looks like very strong evidence. What I think is significant, if a innocent verdict comes down from the jury by any chance, I think that will strengthen Trump and his criticism of the special counsel's office. On the other hand, if a guilty verdict comes down, I think that will work to undercut Trump's effort to essentially end the special counsel.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Jim, if found guilty, though, can Paul Manafort still make a plea deal? Does he have a second chance there?
Oh, I think he certainly does have that option, it seems to me. And, he's apparently in this particular trial, there are 18 counts against him. It'll be interesting to see, say some of the tax fraud charges, maybe he comes out guilty on those, but some of the loan application, because some of the testimony on that I read, suggested, there was this banker in Chicago that was really interested in giving him these loans, whatever his loan application said. And so maybe there'll be this kind of mixed verdict. I suspect there'll be more of this kind of mixed verdict that comes out of the jury. I guess I am predicting it, but it seems more likely that might be the outcome. And then it'll be really interesting to see what Manafort does. And I think the other interesting thing it will be what the judge imposes, because he's been very intrusive, if you will, or very controlling of this trial. And he's going to have some discretion here in terms of any kind of penalty if there are some guilty verdicts here. So I think we have we have not just Manafort and his options, but also what the judge will do, because the judge has been kind of really critical that that you're only interested in Trump, you're really not interested in Manafort. And tax fraud cases usually don't get quite the same high profile that this one has engendered, and certainly the number of counts here.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes before we take a break. Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer with us. Let's go to one of our listeners. Reggie is listening in Oskaloosa. Not much time before we go to break. Reggie, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that I was in the military. I've had 2 security clearances, so I know a little bit about this.
Mm-hmm.
And Omarosa, she can record things, but the recording she made in the Situation Room, that is illegal. You are not supposed to take recording devices into secure areas.
Right.
She should not have had any recording device in there. So just the fact she was in there and recording could open her up for legal problems.
Right. And I understand by reading, perhaps you have too, Reggie, that they have evidently a Dropbox, a procedure for taking care of such electronic devices on the way into a Situation Room type conversation. But does it surprise you?
Yeah, I know more about it than just reading about it.
But I mean, does it surprise you in reading those accounts that the enforcement was not there? People are just trusted, right?
Yeah, I'm actually very surprised, especially for someone who, is just, with her experience in secure matters, with very little experience, was allowed to take something into that room.
Yeah, interesting.
So,
Reggie, thank you. They're saying he has some military service and has gone through security clearances, Reggie, in Oskaloosa. Comments on that before we close here, Jim?
Well, yeah, I'd be interested to know exactly how she was so successful in all of these taping. I mean, it's really quite remarkable, and the clarity of some of the of the taping really impresses me that she should get General Kelly and such a sort of articulate and clear voice. So I think that there will be, some investigation of this. I just wonder how long the administration really wants to carry on this kind of exchange with her, because it seems to me all that it's doing is sort of dragging this out, and I'm not sure to what end for the administration at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll take a break, and we'll be back with more from Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer with us as well from Grinnell College. When we come back, we'll want to talk about that standoff, that escalation with Turkey. We'll turn to foreign policy, what's happening there, the Turkish currency plummeting since last week. I don't know if it's lost almost half its value. Talk about implications there, political implications, geopolitical implications, because, of course, Turkey occupies a interesting geographical space on the globe and is a member of NATO, if I'm not mistaken, a member of NATO with the largest standing army. We'll talk about it when we get back. Also, Michael Avenatti in Iowa, the Trump-bashing attorney, says he may be interested in a presidential run. He was testing the waters for 2020. We'll talk about when we come back. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, you want to tune in. We'll talk with some researchers at the University of Iowa exploring on the cutting edge of research into dementia and Alzheimer's tomorrow on the program. We hope you'll join us today. It's Politics Wednesday with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. As usual, looking at the political landscape, picking out a few things to discuss, to have their analysis on. We'd like to have you join our conversation in just a few minutes. We want to talk about Michael Avenatti, the attorney's visit to Iowa, others who are testing the waters for 2020. And a gentleman, as I read the front page of the New York Times, I'm reminded of a question that's been with the Democrats since 2016 after those losses. What does the party stand for? Perhaps that's a good question for our listeners to chime in on this second half hour of Politics Wednesday. What does the Democratic Party stand for? What should it stand for in order to wrestle back control of the White House in 2020, of the House, the Senate? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Let's go abroad before returning to domestic politics. Wayne, Turkey has been thrown into some rough waters. We're hearing over the last few days its currency, the lira, losing 25% of its value since last week. I sense, believe if you go back a couple warm months, it's almost half its value has been lost. The president there in Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is fighting off U.S. sanctions that seem to have accelerated what is seen as a longer-term decline in the economy there. Erdogan casting the economic crisis as a national struggle. Tell us what you see going on, Wayne.
Well, one, you have a regime that is not very secure. It overcame a coup several years ago. It's increasingly authoritarian. The economy is not doing well, which has led to the decline in the value of the currency. The problem is that Turkey is deeply in debt to banks in Western Europe, and most of the loans are either in dollars or in euros, and with a devalued currency, that raises questions about the ability of Turkey to pay back. And so foreign investors and foreign banks are very antsy about all of this, and there's fears that this could spread to other developing countries as well or deeply in debt. Then you have this business of an American clergyman who has been held in jail being linked to the coup that took place, or the attempted coup that took place several years ago. And, of course, he's an American citizen, and Trump wants him back in the United States, and he imposed sanctions on Turkey, which aggravate the economic situation. So now it's a standoff. Erdogan won't back down, and Trump won't back down. Will this contribute to the economic collapse of Turkey? And if that happens, will it spread to other countries? And also, Turkey is, as I think you mentioned, Ben, is critical to NATO. And will this endanger Turkey's relationship with NATO? It has probably the biggest European army, I think I'm right on this, that is in NATO.
Mm-hmm. The Turkish President Erdogan calling yesterday for Turks to boycott American products, including iPhones, pointed out in one article that I read, interesting, the iPhone, which Erdogan used to help fend off that coup a couple years ago. Jim, when you look at this whole deal, and Wayne nicely sort of detailed the different facets of this, what are your concerns going forward with what we're seeing put into action in
Well,
in
if I
Washington.
Could just add one other thing about, he mentioned about the importance of Turkey to NATO here. Of course, the United States has a very important base access there. Incirlik Air Base in southeastern Turkey is, obviously been critical over the decades for the United States presence and for NATO presence, but it also has some British forces as well as Turkish forces. So it's been a real anchor, if you will, in terms of the NATO alliance. There are a couple other complications that have added, and that's been over Syria. And the United States position backing the Kurds who are taking on ISIS. And that's also a source of antagonism with the Turkish government, because they have long been concerned about efforts of the Kurds to obtain independence or to obtain an independent state. And so they have not been at all enthusiastic about the Americans supporting the Kurds against ISIS. They were for a time much willing, the Turkish government, to overthrow or try to overthrow the Syrian government, Assad. But now they seem to have moved back towards allowing Assad in as long as the Kurds don't get further advancement. In fact, Turkey has moved closer to Russia on this. So it's not only this economic kind of issue that has divided the Americans and the Turks, but also these kind of political issues, political military issues that go into this case of Syria and Iraq and ISIS and the Kurds. So it's really it's much like the Middle East in some ways, of the sort of the cross-cutting kind of issues that reinforce various positions of one group versus another.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, Jim, a way to get back to or a path forward that is more stable for the U.S. and NATO?
Well, one of the problems, it seems to me, and one of the issues that of President Trump imposing these additional tariffs here on Turkey is not only the weak in the economy, as was pointed out, but what it really does also, and Erdogan has been, you know, very much a nationalist, very much a populist, if you will. And I think this also probably strikes up and rises up the sense of nationalism and makes it even more difficult to get accommodation. And I think from, you know, what I teach about in terms of economic sanctions to get political change are often very difficult because they raise this issue of nationalism, but they also raise the issue of other countries coming in. Will the Russians for instance, see an opening here and take advantage of it with regard to their relationship with Turkey?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to one of our callers, I think, who has a tie, formerly perhaps, or in the present, Janice in Iowa City. What's your connection to Turkey? What do you want to talk about? Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I am a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer, and I spent about a third of my or a chunk of my career there, about a total of 6 years, have followed and met Erdogan a number of times. I would say that I have a few quick points. One is I actually believe that Erdogan, after getting the constitution changed and getting himself elected president, is in an almost unassailable position from the point of view of elections, unless the opposition manages to come together. I think that President Trump tweeting about this and putting sanctions on has actually given Erdogan an excuse to blame the U.S. Mm-hmm. rather than go back and look at their own policies. And I also wanted to make one quick point about people who were imprisoned after the coup. Thousands have been imprisoned. But I would like to point out that there are two very long-term U.S. Mission Turkey employees who have been in prison since February of 2017, one of whom I worked with very closely, and has worked for the U.S. government for 37 years, laying their lives on the line. These are the people I would like to see us, the U.S., stand up for.
Mm-hmm. Janice in Iowa City, thank you for your analysis. Very good. I'm going to put you on hold if you could, if you'd like to give us some contact information to one of our producers. When I put you on hold, they'll get in contact with you. We might be in contact in the future. It sounds like you have a lot of expertise that may be good for us to share with our Iowa Public Radio audience in the future. Thank you, Janice. And any final comments on what Janice had to say or Turkey before we turn to another topic? Okay. Let's talk about China. When you guys are on, we always have a new development in China. Let me read a little bit from the New York Times because I want to see how this strikes you as a development in the what we'll call a trade war with China. Reports that while China's leaders have sought to project confidence in the face of President Trump's tariffs and trade threats, growing signs of unease inside the political establishment in Beijing. This from the New York Times. In recent days, officials from the commerce industry, the police and other agencies have summoned exporters to ask about plans to lay off workers or shift supply chains to other countries. With stocks slumping and the currency dropping 9% against the dollar since mid-April, censors have been deleting a torrent of criticism online, some of it directed at President Xi Jinping's leadership. State news outlets, by contrast, have sought to promote the official line, with the authorities restricting the use of the phrase trade war. I think Donald Trump doesn't like the word trade war, the phrase trade war either. Wayne, what do you make of that? We thought China is on the long side of the lever. This report may indicate otherwise?
At least it indicates that China or the Chinese government feels a little bit more insecure about its position than it did originally. I think that before all of this started, there a sense of overconfidence in the Chinese leadership that they could withstand a trade dispute with the United States. But I think now that there's some question in terms of the unemployment issue and that it may over the long term have some implications for political stability, and we know that the Chinese Communist Party is very, very concerned about keeping any kind of political instability from developing. And then I think this gets linked to concern about President Xi's increasing power, and that maybe he's pushing too hard.
Mm-hmm. Jim, no sign that the president that I can see is backing down on this. Can he hold the line here? Do you see it shifting at all?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly the issue with regard to, corn and soybeans, for example, and the implications for Iowa farmers, I think there's continuous pressure on that. And I think if it goes on, beyond, say 1 year, then he's going to, the president is going to suffer a little bit from this. If I could just add one thing about China, too. I mean, the comment you read there was about switching supply chains. Mm-hmm. The problem for China, of course, is it's not so easy to switch supply chains when they've been so dependent on, say, the American supply chains to move to other countries here. We might think that this can be done automatically, but even, moving out of American soybeans or American corn is not quite as easy as simply flipping a switch here.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up the hour by talking to you about a visit by the Trump-bashing attorney Michael Avenatti. Came to Iowa to rev up Democrats, test the waters for 2020. He's exploring a presidential run, and he was at the Iowa State Fair shaking hands, having selfies taken. This is the lawyer known for representing the adult film actress, the porn star, Stormy Daniels, in her case against the president. And he spoke also at the Democratic Wingding fundraiser Friday night in Clear Lake. Let's listen to a little bit of a conversation he had with the Des Moines Register reporter at the Iowa State Fair. He urged Democrats to choose a candidate who can go toe-to-toe with President Trump. Let's listen.
Here to listen to the great people of Iowa, explore the fair, and figure out if it makes any sense to run for the presidency or not.
How seriously are you considering this?
I'm serious about considering it. I haven't made a decision as to what I'm going to do. I'll make the decision in the coming weeks, maybe a little bit longer than that. But the bottom line is that I'm worried about the Democratic Party nominating somebody that cannot be competitive against and beat Donald Trump in 2020. And that is the number one question that the party has to ask is, can this potential nominee, beat Donald Trump? There's a lot of people whose names are being mentioned, and I think they're exceptional politicians. I think they're exceptional leaders, but there is no way, in my view, that some of them can beat Donald Trump in the general election. And I think it is a critical mistake if the party does not take that question into account as the number one question as it relates to picking a nominee.
And you talk about beating Trump. If you beat Trump, what prepares you to lead the country?
Well, number one, I think I'm highly intelligent. Number two, I think people would be willing to work with me and join me in the effort. I think I'm pretty good at listening to people around me that I surround myself with. And I think that I can mobilize the country and really bring people together towards a common cause.
Okay, Michael Avenatti, a few days ago, talking with the Des Moines Register. Other declared 2020 candidates, U.S. Representative John Delaney of Maryland, completed a 99-county tour, I think, last weekend. Entrepreneur Andrew Yang as well. What do you think about this message? He says Democrats need a fighter. They're fooling themselves, he argues, if they don't think the 2020 contest will be a battle of personalities more than a contest of ideas. I asked earlier, just a few minutes ago, the question is, what does the Democratic Party stand for? I don't know if Michael Avenatti would agree with that, Wayne. He's saying the question is, who can beat Trump?
Right. Let me say first that it's awfully early to say what it will take to beat Trump in 2020. The Mueller report, I think, is going to be very important, and this congressional election is going to be important. With that said, I think he's right that you'll need somebody who can, if Trump is still in the race at that stage of the game, you will need somebody that can go toe-to-toe with him. On the other hand, Trump did have an appeal to some basic concerns in society. And will the Democrats or the Democratic candidate, even if that person is charismatic, have this broad general appeal in terms of some kind of social concerns?
Mm-hmm. Jim, your thoughts?
Well, I have to swallow hard when I think about Avenatti as a candidate, because it seems to me that he has been very much, a function of the media. You know, with the Stormy Daniels thing, I don't know, he had some number of appearances on television, day after day after day. And this, in some ways, looks like more of this kind of monitoring attention for himself and maybe his law practice and so on. And also the Democrats have said they want to provide, their motto is, a better deal. And, you know, and they have talked about competence as the critical variable here that is needed in the White House. And by that interview and certainly by his discussion so far, he's not even willing to, it doesn't seem to be on top of these kind of issues at all. So I'm not sure, even with his sort of adversarial kind of approach, that the public is going to want a couple candidates going head-to-head. I think that's one of the ways to really further divide the country, it seems to me, and further alienate a lot of people. So I don't want to throw too much cold water on this candidacy.
Well, it sounds like it answers the question of whether Donald Trump as a former reality TV star is an anomaly or whether there's a continuation in other types of candidates similar to him, right?
I hope it was an anomaly, I guess.
Jeff is joining us from Cedar Rapids. We're winding up the hour. Jeff, talking about the politics of 2018, 2020, and beyond. What are your thoughts?
I was just saying, I actually think that we need to put a bigger focus on technology and securing the threats as we move forward, such as automation and job loss that we might see in the future due to those technologies advancing.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. And do you work in a sector where that is threatened?
I'm actually a student right now, but I see all these technologies that we're looking at in business school and the abilities that they have. And then there's also even, these leading minds that are developing AI technology, and they're pushing for a pact of sorts to say that no government should be designing autonomous weapons in the case that this AI does get developed at some point.
Right. Interesting. You could do a whole political discussion, Jeff, on just that. We've seen the export of a number of jobs to developing countries for lower wages. But I think what Jeff is also referencing here is that we have an automation revolution before us, and also AI, that a lot of our manufacturing will not go overseas. It will be done very efficiently by machines, very few people manning those machines. Jim, don't you think that would be a political discussion we could have, too? What do you do? What do you do in such a work atmosphere?
Absolutely. I think, and his point is that we need somebody, in the White House or certainly in the Congress that have that technological knowledge that can help us, sort of work through this. I think one of the things that I would add to that, of course, and that fits into this and this whole issue of cybersecurity too, because I think it ties into this kind of automation and so on, and the stealing of intellectual property here. And so that also is a kind of a skill set that I think would be very, very helpful to future political candidates.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, any words to leave us with, casting our glance?
The other thing that I think may start coming back as a result of the huge number of fires in the West is the issue of climate change, which for the Trump administration has been pretty much back burner. But there are stories coming out now, and there's the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I think can be coming out in October. So I wonder whether climate change will again come back on the political agenda by 2020.
Right, and perhaps sooner than we think. When reading in Politico today, I see that they have a report how the Trump administration is preparing to unveil its plan to undo Obama's climate regulation. Undoubtedly, climate regulation, climate change is what we'll talk about in future politics days. We've run out of time for now. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim and Wayne, thank you. It's been a delightful hour with the two of you. Thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Tomorrow on the program, a reminder, one of our topics, we'll talk about dementia and Alzheimer's. We'll talk with researchers in that area at the University of Iowa tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also helped today from Lucy McGeehee and Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.